It's my great pleasure today for this luncheon session to introduce a couple of really impressive people with extraordinarily long CVs as we had this morning, which is always a sign of excellence. The toughest job for me today is to do justice to that in a summarised version. But the presenters today are not presenting in the context of the presentation in this luncheon, but actually going to sit back looking as relaxed as they are now and field questions from the audience and perhaps from the chairperson today. And I have a couple of ones just to wind things up early on in the presentation. But I'd like to introduce our first person sitting here is Siobhan Toohill, who is General Manager, Corporate Responsibility and Sustainability for Stockland, Australia's largest diversified property group. Siobhan guides CRNS across Stockland's operations, encompassing the development, retail, commercial and industrial and capital partners divisions. Siobhan has been recently appointed to the Property Council of Australia's National Sustainability Roundtable. Apparently, if you can say that quickly, you're eligible for election. And sits on the Operations Task Force of the Australian Business and Community Network. Our second person on stage is Dr. Ian Woods, who is the Senior Research Analyst for the AMP Capital Investors Sustainable Alpha Funds, Australian Equity Team. Ian's prime role is to assess the management of intangible assets of companies through the environmental, social and governance assessment of companies on the Australian stock market and encouraging these companies in the areas of corporate social responsibility and sustainability. So their qualifications are not questioned, cannot be questioned. They're here today to interact with the group, and I'd like to offer a prize for those who ask the best questions, but there isn't one available. So I think what we'll do today is just philosophically say that there may be a key question and you're to be congratulated if that was the one. So there'll be a roving microphone that will come around during the lunch session, and if anyone would like to ask a question, they need to put their hand up and they can facilitate that question to our speakers, if I could call them that for today. I might begin the ball rolling with a question with very little controversy attached to it, perhaps to aim at Ian first. My question, Ian, and you're aware of this question, and we got this question together, so he's not offended. Is the investment community interested in CSR? And if so, why would they be interested?
Yeah, interesting question. I think what happened at the beginning of this decade was there were about three things which came together which made the investment community sort of say things have changed. One was some of the corporate governance failures that especially happened in the US, Enron and WorldCom. So people started saying governance is a big issue. The whole issue of climate change really started to get onto the perspective of saying this is fundamentally going to change business and the way business operates. So here's something we need to make sure we understand and manage for long-term value. And the third one, I think, was the whole response to the whole issue of globalisation and how people were responding to that. And I think there were some in the investment community just went, hey, here are three issues, and one's an environmental, one's a social issue, one's a governance issue, which are really going to shape the world in which we're going to operate in, which companies our investment's going to operate in. We need to understand and manage and incorporate these issues better. So that's sort of very much at the big picture area of the investment community. And they've struggled to work out how to do that, but you've seen things such as the Carbon Disclosure Project come through, which is asking companies about managing issues, and a few other things. At an individual level, our particular fund sort of says, well, we look at those issues because we actually think we make better investment decisions. And the reason why I say that is because if you do an analysis of the ASX 200, 77% of the value of a company on the Australian, on average, of a company on the ASX is in their intangible asset. So what is intangible assets? Well, what are intangible assets? They're about brand, they're about human capital, they're about intellectual capital, they're about the value of the relationships they have with their employees and their suppliers. So as an investment analyst, if I can understand how a company is managing those issues, for better or for worse, I hopefully will be able to make a better investment decision. So from my perspective, looking at environmental, social and governance issues gives me a real insight into how companies are managing key risks and how they're managing the capability which maintains and creates value of the company.
I think it's what we're finding is that it's not so much the analysts who we engage with from an investor relations perspective, but we certainly get an awful lot of surveys, and I'm sure there are many in the room who get an awful lot of surveys from different investor groups who are wanting to know what it is that we're doing as an organisation and really wanting to judge how we're actually performing in this area. So that's certainly kind of the arena where we're sort of seeing a lot of push. We certainly know that that the big end, the super funds, are increasingly engaged, and they do want to know what we are doing. It's not yet trickling down to the analysts, but I'm sure that it will be coming, and we need to be prepared for that.
Siobhan, what do you see as the trends and challenges in CSR reporting moving forward from your perspective?
Well, I should first say that we've only done our second report, for us that's been quite a journey. We did our first report, which was really an opportunity to say what it is that we stand for, and to really define what we mean by corporate responsibility and sustainability. Corporate responsibility for us is the responsibility to all the different kinds of people that we interact with in our organisation. And sustainability for us is how we actually sustain the organisation going forward. And that was really the crux of the first report, to say, well, this is how we're doing it. And we broke it down into the traditional spheres. Many of you will be familiar with business and the community in the UK, who talk about this arena in terms of marketplace, community, environment and people. And that was the way that we approached it. And in our second report, we were able to talk about some of the performance and really start to get down to the measures. And I think the measures are a real challenge. Really building the systems within your organisation to be able to account for your full performance. The other challenge that we took on in our second year report, and I think it's certainly a challenge, and it certainly came out of a discussion that we had, I had with Ian around the table with a number of other property professionals, is the assurance piece, or telling the full story of how your organisation has performed. It's not just simply putting forward the good story, the good news, and we certainly heard from a number of speakers earlier today. It's about providing a full account of how your organisation has performed around the ESG areas. And part of that was we used an assurance tool to really, explore that, to engage with stakeholders and really flush out what are the issues that we need to talk about around our organisation. So I think that's, and I think for most organisations, that's a sign of maturity in your reporting, and we hope to do better as we move into the next phase of our reporting. So we're gearing up to do our third year report, and the big challenge for us is to now go back to our stakeholders and say, well, how did you find last year's report? What do you expect in our report this year? What are some of the good things, but also some of the things that you want to hear about that perhaps we can do better?
Ian, did you want to comment on?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's probably three things which I think are probably the key challenges for people writing reports. One is who the audience is, because inevitably these reports are for an incredibly diverse range of people. What I'll be looking for will be very different from maybe your employees, who will be another key audience for the report, and or maybe the community or a particular part of the community which you're asking for. So I think that's a real challenge, to write something which is trying to cater for very diverse interests. The second one, which I find interesting reading a lot of reports, is the report actually clearly enunciating why the particular thing they're talking about is an issue for them. It's extraordinary that a lot of reports will talk about a whole lot of issues, but they never actually talk about why it is an issue for them. Why is it important? How does it interact with their business? And obviously, from an investment perspective, I find that actually a critical question. Some issues are interesting that you talk about, but why actually is it important, and how does it link in with your business strategy? The third one is, I think, picks up on what Siobhan said, is dealing with the things you're not good at, and the whole issue of accountability. Because for one of the things I look for, which I think is interesting, is the ability to be accountable for both the good things and the bad things in a public domain through a sustainability report says a lot about the culture of the organisation. Because I think accountability is a key criteria for any culture within an organisation. And how you deal with the bad things as well as the good things says a lot even more about the accountability or the culture within an organisation. So I think, and it reflects, as Siobhan said, a real maturity, I think, within the organisation to deal with accountability. So they're probably the three challenges I see with, at a high level with some of the issues with reporting.
Thanks very much, Ian. Siobhan. I'm happy to open the floor to questions now. So if is anyone who'd like to ask a question, we have a lady over there. Thank you. Just give us your name and your organisation, if you're happy to.
Hello, Annette Fraser from MacArthur Cole again. I would like to know how important you think the Global Reporting Initiative is in reporting sustainability these days, because my company is just embarking on the CSR reporting route, and we're not really sure how far we need to go.
Global Reporting Initiative, I attended a conference recently in Europe, and according to the stats at that conference, about a quarter or a third of organisations that report globally use the Global Reporting Initiative as the basis for their report. It's known as GRI for short, and GRI has gone through some changes in the last 18 months and is now known as G3. We use GRI because it provides some sort of degree of comparability with others who are reporting. It provides a good framework, and people, particularly users of the report, and actually to pick up on Ian's previous comment, we've learned a lot about audience over the last 2 years around sustainability reports. We very much first targeted at our, you know, we thought our, and I think rightly so, our audience for our first report was our employees. However, we've realised that there are a lot of CR specialists who really interrogate our reports, and the GRI index is pretty important for them to be able to find information. It does require a lot of work in terms of setting up systems, and also I think there's some things to be explored around the application levels. So GRI now says either you're reporting at a C, B or A level, and we got to B plus last year and we were pretty excited about that. But my board committee, and I have a CRNS board committee, and they said, well, why didn't you get to A? And, you know, because I was seeing that as an indicator of quality. The thing to be mindful of is that C, B or A is more an indicator of bandwidth. How many criteria have you addressed from the GRI is not an indicator of the quality. It's the plus that demonstrates the quality in the sense that you put it out for independent assurance. So I think that's something to be really mindful of. I think doing GRI to level C and getting a plus is, you know, more important that you've actually had that independent verification or check. But I do think it's important in terms of having that comparability. And the other element is around sector standards. In the property sector, we're looking at the development of a sector component that will help us to better compare ourselves against our peers. We want that. We think it's really important that we know exactly how we're tracking against each other. And I think there's some real challenges at the moment in reporting around comparability. So GRI is a good start around that.
Yeah, it's a good question, especially for those who are starting reporting, because I think if you look at the GRI or G3, it's an incredibly daunting exercise. And I guess from my perspective, I'll go back to my second point yesterday, I think what I look for is focusing on the issues which are important as perceived by the company. And if you're starting off, I think I'd really focus on those. And sometimes that'll be a hard enough decision to say, well, what are actually our important issues? You then might go to the GRI and use as a framework to say, gee, GRI framework says maybe some of these other things are important as well, and that might ask you to say, well, are they or aren't they? And maybe review your views about what might other key issues. But I wouldn't be slavish to the GRI, because I end up finding a lot of stuff and people say, here's the GRI sort of information for this particular issue, and they don't put it in any context. They don't say it's important to them. They don't use it in any way. Their data is collected and they've reported it and they've put it in the report, and it may or may not be of interest or relevance or comparable. So from my perspective, it's a report's got to be something that adds value to the organisation as well as the stakeholders. So focusing on the things which are important to the company and their key stakeholders, for me, is where any company should start in their reporting.
I think in the last year for us, doing our second report, the big issue of materiality, which is a big word that gets bandied about in corporate responsibility, but materiality, basically talking about what's critical to the success of your organisation. We worked through talking to external stakeholders, but also interview people within our organisation to come up with a list of material issues that we needed to report against. And our assurance provider held us to that and then talked about some of the things that they were of the view that we didn't talk through sufficiently against those material issues. But that's what you really do need to focus on. So for us in property, it's, you know, a big one for us is around the eco-efficiency of our office buildings and our retail buildings. You know, it's a pretty obvious one for us, as well as health and safety, not so much of our people, but of our supply chain. So the people who build our buildings, we're not a builder. So, you know, they were the material issues for us. And they don't necessarily come up under GRI. Mm. Health and safety of our supply chain doesn't, but it's absolutely critical to our reputation.
We've seen examples of mandating behaviour as opposed to best practice thought leadership behaviour. Certainly in our organisation, we're very keen to have the appropriate debates before we start beginning to try and put a fence around how one should report any particular information. But there has been a history in reporting worldwide in all organisations of that level of quality you need in a report that's going to get that clarity that sends the messages you want to send. Do you think there's been some really great improvements in this area, or do you think it's moving towards turning into a field of sort of standard reporting mechanisms that really don't drive key messages for individual organisations?
I think the standard report, personally, I think the standard reporting is improving. I think as people sort of move from I think people write reports for a little while and then they're not quite sure why they're writing them. They're writing them because they think they should write them. And then after a while they actually start asking the questions, why are we writing this report? And I think that's a really helpful stage to go through. And that's when you start seeing the real improvements in the report, because they really start putting, let's say, what's important to them and why, and they, you can just see the way they describe the issues in a quite different way. So I am seeing improvement, but it is kind of a journey for a lot of people, and they have to ask themselves some hard questions at times about what they're reporting and why are we doing this and who our audience is.
Yeah, I do think it comes back to this issue of making sure that you're actually putting the right material into your report in the first place, and it has to be checked, and you have to understand, you know, what your stakeholders are actually looking for. That's the challenge, is making sure it's actually relevant, meaningful, and you're actually fully accounting for what you've done in the previous year rather than simply checking a box. And it's really important that you just don't end up in that situation of just checking the box. There's a standard that we chose to use last year called the AA1000 Assurance Standard. That really does push you down the line of working through this materiality process of understanding what's important to your organisation, and then making sure that it's actually complete and it's accurate. But more critically, that you've actually responded to the issues. So not only have you identified them, but you've actually responded to the concerns that your stakeholders might have, whether internal or external to your organisation. And yeah, that really tests the quality of your report, and that's certainly been supported by our board committee, who has ownership around our report.
The issue of, Siobhan, we were speaking before about the fact that you prepare a corporate responsibility sustainability report, that you spend some time defining that report as that, and that it is a separate document, and it's referred to in your annual report, but is actually a standalone, as opposed to other options where people report on an integrated basis in the annual reports. Why did you go to that decision, and how is it benefiting your organisation and its stakeholders?
It's a really interesting area. A number of organisations choose to actually integrate their sustainability report into their annual report, and I think it means different things for different kinds of organisations. I think there's a fundamental part. It comes down to sheer size of the report. So if you do want to go down the GRI pathway, if you do want to fully interrogate all your material issues, you are going to end up with a report, on average, globally, around 50 pages. So it's pretty hard to pull that into your annual report, and particularly the way in which we're seeing annual reports evolve here in Australia as well. So we do see that there's some value in building that detailed report. We the way that we choose to do that is we publish that to our web, and then we publish print a concise report, which is much smaller as well, and then we reference that in the annual report. That's the pathway we've gone down, but there are plenty of organisations who seek to integrate it but end up with the very chunky annual report.
Yeah, I think Siobhan's right there. One of the challenges is of integrating it is you end up with an annual report which is absolutely monstrously large, and just the cost associated with that and the trees and everything else. So I think what I'm sort of seeing, and probably encourage people, is almost take, you know, hopefully you've got a 3-page executive summary to your sustainability report, and that might actually slot nicely into your annual report, where you talk about the key things: what's our performance been, how's it changed, and what are our key issues in front of us in the future. And they're sort of the key things you can put in an annual report. And some of the detail that goes behind that can be either in a standalone report where you go into some of the detail, or either on the web. One of the other things I think I'm finding, as people write reports, they end up finding that they're saying the same things they said last year and the year before and the year before that. And having read them, I say, I read that last year, the year before and the year before that. And I think there's also a bit of a trend to sort of focusing the report on the what's changed, which I think is actually a positive move, and maybe using the website, to focus on some of the things which haven't changed. So say some of the things that don't change as much is, say, your management systems or your structure of your management systems. That's important to describe, I think, how you manage those things, but they're probably something you can sit on a website and refer to an annual report rather than keep writing about the same thing year on, year in and year out. So then the report becomes smaller and it can focus on what's changed since you last wrote your last report, and refer to the broader things of how we manage environment and safety and community in a on a website, for example.
I think the use of technology is really important, although some of the feedback we've had and certainly other organisations have had is just don't jump to an HTML report if you can't do it really, really well and if it's not what your stakeholders are looking for, because I'm told that quite often the specialists who are actually going through a report just can't find all the information in the HTML. They simply want the report in their hands. The ability to leave information on the website is really important. We refer in our GRI index to material that's on the website. But also different organisations such as the telecommunications sector that has a very young audience, very young customer base, are really getting really savvy around putting information around what they're doing around the sustainability agenda on their website and doing it in really interesting and really creative ways. And I was really excited about some of the things that I saw when I was in Europe. And there were lessons that I'll be taking back to our organisation on that.
Alex, Jeff Allen from Allen Consulting. I'd just like to ask, particularly Ian, a general question about ethical investment funds. And we know the complexity of them. Some screen out, some best in class, and other approaches different, and so on. And a lot of them, I think, are somewhat value laden, which could be illustrated by the fact of the issues around BHP's acquisition of Western Mining with uranium, creating challenges for people who'd screened out uranium but still wanting BHP equities and so on. The broader question is, what's the current status of ethical investment funds in the broader environment of investment, and what do you think its future is likely to be in Australia?
The most broad definition of ethical funds in Australia, they've probably increased to the order of 60 or 80% a year over the last 4 or 5 years. Our particular fund would fit into that broad umbrella, and our fund's basically doubled in size over each of the last 3 years, so we've got about $2.8 billion under management, so that's a reasonable size fund. So I think they're growing. I think what's happening now is because the broader investment community, through things such as the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment, there's going to be starting to be a bit of a smudge between some of the more sustainability-focused ethical funds and what the mainstream funds are doing in terms of incorporating ESG issues. So again, our fund, people can see it as a mainstream fund or as an ethical fund, and we don't actually mind which hat you want to use, because we kind of see that's where mainstream funds are going to go anyway. And I've forgotten what your second question is, sorry. I think they'll probably stay much the same. I mean, generally they might own 1 or 2% of a company, so generally they won't be a large part of the shareholders of companies. But I say, I think what you're going to find is that things ethical funds will talk about, the issues are going to be taken up by the mainstream. So the ethical funds were probably the first ones to talk about climate change is a really big issue. And now everyone's talking about climate change is a really big issue. So the investor group on climate change has got funds under management of somewhere like $600, $700 billion under management, saying this is a big issue for investors. Whereas 7 years ago, it might have been a couple of funds worth a couple of $100 million. So I think a lot of those issues are going to be mainstream. But you'll still have people who don't like uranium or don't like alcohol and tobacco, so they'll always be there for those particular people.
I think we're also seeing some of the analysts beginning to report on how we're doing as well. So about 18 months ago, Elaine Pryor from Citi produced a report called The Winners and Losers from Climate Change and analysed the ASX 100 in terms of how we were tracking. And she used information from our corporate responsibility reports and our Carbon Disclosure Project reports. It had a lot of traction in the media, and it certainly grabbed a lot of attention across corporations. And it was interesting to see that the property sector was rated generally quite high because we were seen to be a winner, given that we're able to respond in a positive sense to the issues around climate change in terms of creating buildings that can deal better with these issues. But it was for us, it was a really interesting kind of awakening moment that this information is being utilised by analysts and they're getting media traction around it as well.
Alison Ewing of Westpac. I had a question. We talked a bit about size of reports. I had a question around frequency. Is once a year going to be enough?
Sorry, once a year, is it going to be enough or too much?
Will people be looking for information more frequently than that if we're talking about if there truly are material issues?
Well, if they're material issues, you'll still be bound by the ASX disclosure requirements about continuous disclosure. So if there's something which is material in terms of a share price, you're required to report that. I think generally these issues fit within an annual reporting cycle, the same as generally the financial report does, especially if you're just focusing on what's changed in the performance over the year and reporting back on targets that you set last year or objectives you set. I think the one thing that might change there is the issue of under an emissions trading scheme and whether companies need to report more regularly on that particular issue. I know someone from the Australian Financial Markets Association said there should almost be quarterly reporting of greenhouse gas emissions. Yeah, that probably sent shivers down a lot of companies' spines. But, and that's all about making, if you want to have an emissions trading market, you need some good disclosure for the market to work. I'm not sure you will need quarterly reporting, but that was interesting to see that that's what someone said. If you want an efficient market, that's the sort of reporting you're going to need.
From our perspective, we're comfortable with the annual reporting at the moment. I guess stakeholders might shift their view on that, but certainly internally, there's a lot of appetite for more frequent reporting. In fact, monthly reporting on a range of sustainability issues within the organisation. Mm. Our executive committee and our board are very keen to see how we're tracking on a month-to-month basis. I guess they're pretty keen to make sure that we hit our annual targets, as I'm sure you would experience at Westpac as well. Actually, on that also, employees are very engaged, and I think some of the little things that you can do, someone talked about computers this morning. A really wonderful experience that we had in Stockland this year is that we moved into our new head office, and some of the things that we've done in that new head office, we've utilised the Green Star rating tool, the Australian Building Greenhouse rating tools as well, and we've tracked information around how we're saving energy in the building in monitors in our cafe. And employees really enjoy that real-time information, and we also rate how many computers get turned off every night on each floor and, you know, drive this internal competition. And that, I guess, helps to really build and sustain momentum from an employee perspective as well. So I guess, you know, reporting frequency, I guess it really depends on what the issue is and who the stakeholder audience is.
Now, I think the CEO wants to ask a question, and I'll tell you why he does, because earlier on in the presentation I said I'd like to give an award for the best question. The market is alive and well. Siemens have come to me and will be giving a Gigaset portable phone system delivered to your place of work for the best question. The CEO is not eligible. I just wanted to make that clear.
Alex,
CEO.
You've blown my cover, Alex. Now, the question I wanted to ask was one for Ian. And Ian, I can understand that your focus is very much in the sustainability and the fund sector in that regard. But as you look across the broader analyst community, certainly my impression is that very much determinations and assessments of organisational performance are really done on the basis of short-term financial analysis, but also assessments of prospective financial performance. So when it really comes down to those hard issues of whether you're going to recommend you buy, hold, or actually, you know, sell a stock, do you ever see the day when these kinds of variables, which are really around the longer term issues of sustainability, is going to have a broader or a bigger influence than some of those financial dynamics that we're much more familiar with?
Pity you can't get the prize, really. That was a good question. And I wish I had a good answer for it. It's a really tricky issue, that whole issue of some of the dynamics operating at different levels. I think, to be honest, a lot of portfolio managers don't necessarily use a buy, hold, sell recommendation for their investment decisions. They actually use the information that the analyst presents and then goes away and makes their own decision about whether they buy, hold or sell. So really it's about the information that the analyst presents to justify their decision that the good portfolio managers use. And I think that's where some of this sustainability issues or ESG issues or CSR issues might come in, because one of the challenges is for an analyst is to work out what is the likelihood that the company is going to meet expectations of their financial return. You know, are they going to meet profit expectations for 6 months or a year? And so there you have to ask the question, Can the management deliver on what they've said they're going to promise or what the market thinks they're going to deliver? And that's where I think ESG issues really come into it. They're just saying, well, how good is this manager? How do I assess the quality of the management? How well do they manage their capabilities in delivering their strategy? And so I think people will start incorporating it in that way. That won't overcome the short-termism that exists in the market. I don't know how you will. The other thing which I think will happen is you'll get these collective engagement initiatives such as climate change, where the investment community have said, okay, this isn't going to necessarily affect stock price tomorrow or next day or next week or next month, but if the economy and particularly companies aren't managing this issue, at some stage this is going to come home to roost. And so we as investors who are long-term investors in just about all companies in Australia in one way or another need to make sure they're managing that issue, because when it becomes a really big issue, it's going to be too late to be managing it, to be honest. So it's sort of a proactive, are you managing forthcoming risk, which I think is some of the thing that person from Newmont talked about. It's managing those longer-term risks are important. But good question.
Hi, Sonia Errington from the New South Wales Department of Environment and Climate Change. I've noticed a couple of comments which I found quite interesting, particularly looking at alternative capitalism, and I certainly know that came up, and the use of the term corporate social responsibility. My question is, how do the capitalist economists feel about turning into socialists in terms of considering the broader social community in making their business decisions and still meeting their bottom line requirement?
I guess that question is for me being...
I was wondering if the microphone had broken.
Capitalist. Yeah, interesting question. I think that's where the whole issue of semantics comes up, and so people sort of just say, well, I'm not going to go anywhere near that discussion. So you see the investment community, they call it corporate social responsibility, they call it environmental, social and governance issues, because they kind of go down the track of, well, what does corporate social responsibility mean and the conflicts we might have and all that sort of stuff, and go, that's a discussion we probably don't want to go down because it's not going to be very helpful for us, or they might see it as not being helpful. But we do know environmental, social and governance issues are important. And that bit we do understand, we do agree. We still might find it difficult to understand the linkages and how we assess it, but we understand those things are important. So we're going to use the words environmental, social and governance issues as the way of sort of circumventing that discussion. The other thing, so I guess from a more philosophical perspective, is that companies don't operate in a vacuum. And I think, again, I think the person from Newmont,
Christine,
again talked about companies need to operate within a functional economy and society. So if you don't have that base, then it's going to be very hard for you as a company to operate. So there is kind of some sort of enlightened self-interest, which is another expression people use, that some of these things, you do have a well-functioning economy and society, and some of the social and structural issues are being properly addressed. And if you can do something as a company to be part of that, then that's a positive.
It's essentially you have to balance those issues. So you can't do one without doing the other, otherwise you'll impede the success of the organisation. So, and I think, again, Christine and Charles talked extensively around the importance of achieving that balance. I mean, I think the climate change agenda is really interesting because, particularly when you look at the Stern Review, because it's about partnering up the environmental issues with the economy and actually pulling these two issues together very much, and it's really only society that can do something about it. So it really brings into place, the role and good sort of economic behaviour to address the issues. So I think it's really interesting how these things do come together. We can't just pull them out and tease them out and look at them individually.
If I could ask a question, we are a professional body of 120,000 finance professionals, and we have, in the last two to three years, really moved very strongly into these areas. And because we're leading the profession in these debates, we're actually also working on raising the stream of consciousness among the profession about the fact that they are strategic resource advisors and they are contributing to this reporting mechanism quite materially, to use that term. What's been interesting in my journey, in my role in the organisation, has been to look at how contemporary we're now looking at issues, raising issues on our website, and that's become a central portal. And I was interested in your comments about saying part of your report may be on the website, part of it in another place. So we have various information papers that encourage debate from the profession and the community on particular issues such as emissions trading, climate change, confidence in corporate reporting. We've got some papers coming through shortly on the divide between financial and non-financial issues, which is a very important one, we think, and the role of accountants in sustainability. But there's an enormous amount of energy required to actually deliver those messages to people to a level that they'll go and engage with your organisation. I'm interested, we've done a lot of work on that and we're getting good results, but I'm interested for the audience what you're also doing to engage your members, your stakeholders, your various groups into the foray of the areas you're in, because sometimes you can get caught in an office thinking you've changed the world but forgot to tell everyone. So what is it you do about that communication? We've spent a lot of time on it. I'm interested.
It really depends on who your stakeholders are. Something that was also talked a lot about this morning is that it absolutely has to be integrated into your organisation. So it's about how different parts of the business respond to this issue or the issues for them, what's material for them and the stakeholders that they work with. So I'm really excited about some of the work that we're doing at the moment with our procurement team, and what they are doing is beginning to talk to our supply chain, not simply give them a questionnaire that they need to fill out and for us to collect and kind of work out who we're going to work with, but it's about sitting down and having a dialogue with our supply chain, telling them a bit about what we're doing, what we think is important to us or the material issues to us, but also finding out what's material to them, where do they see the shared risks, and also where do they see the opportunities, and then for us to actually look at what are some of the things that we can work on, what are the top three issues that we can work on together. That's a really easy, kind of straightforward way and a really business savvy way to begin to talk about what you're doing, because you're making it really real. It's part of doing business. I think that's, you know, an example of what you can do. It's kind of empowering different parts of the organisation to make it part of their business, reward them for it, absolutely has to be in KPIs, and enable them to get out there and talk to their stakeholders about how they're going to drive the success of the business.
I think from the investment community, one of the things I've tried to do is have some collective action. So myself and Bob Welsh, which maybe many of you know being in Melbourne, put together the investment group on climate change, because we realised that us personally knowing a lot about climate change really didn't actually change anything in particular. So we actually needed to have a group of people in from the investment community who said this is an important issue and the investment community in general needs to understand this issue and how it interacts with their long-term investments, and that the investment community is a legitimate stakeholder into the discussions of, you know, how reporting is done, how an emissions trading scheme should be set up. So those collective things I think were really important to try and get the broader investment community to understand that. And there's a similar thing happening in governance as well, where an issue was raised about lost votes in annual reports or annual general meetings, and per se, one organisation such as AMP Capital couldn't do much about it. They needed everyone to get together to try and solve that problem. The other thing I guess I try to do to encourage change is I'm more than happy to give people feedback on their reports or to talk to people about what their issues are if they're having stakeholder engagement sessions. And I know a number of companies do, and some of them are here, happy to provide to feedback. I try and write feedback to companies' reports, but I don't necessarily get around to it all the time, but more than happy to do that as well.
And I think that, you know, the big collective action, you know, looking at property is definitely around the whole green building agenda, both in terms of existing office buildings and retail buildings and residential, as well as new buildings, and how we can work together to actually establish tools and standards, again, so that we're measuring the same sorts of things, whether it's about Green Star for new buildings or the Australian Building Greenhouse rating for existing office buildings. And then taking the next step, that is to engage the tenants in our retail buildings or our office buildings about how they can achieve greater eco-efficiency and help them actually understand what these tools actually mean and how they can then engage their workforce around these sorts of issues. Because when you bring it back down to the workforce, that's often the bottom line, that's the big driver. It's about engaging your workforce and back into these issues around engagement and reducing turnover.
I think we have one more question.
Yep. Yvonne Barrett from Ernst & Young. I'm obviously very interested in assurance and the value you put on assurance in both of your roles. Might be Siobhan for internal stakeholders or external stakeholders, but Ian, more for the research that you're conducting, do you sort of place an extra weight when assurance is being conducted, and do you look at the methodology that they're doing, the type of service provider that's conducting the assurance?
I mean, as I talked about, you know, we've been on a bit of a journey. We kind of looked at the different kinds of assurance that was available, and we decided that AA1000 was important because for us it asked the right sorts of questions. For us, assurance was not only about saying what was in the report was, you know, the right information and that it was accurate and, you know, responded to stakeholder issues, but also the work that came out of that, the learnings that we got out of that process have then gone back into feed into our strategy, not only just in our corporate responsibility strategy, but business strategy as well. So from our perspective, there was enormous value. We also know that certain stakeholders that we had spoken to also placed a lot of value on the AA1000 assurance standard. We also did a lot of research to understand where this was moving globally as well, and we thought that was the best answer for us. But also, we don't underestimate the amount of work involved in actually achieving it and dealing with or being aware of what it means in terms of having an assurance statement in your report. You know, you can't control that. You don't know what it's going to say. And you know, doing the work to prepare the organisation for what that might look like also takes a lot of work. But you know, we got there in the end, and yeah, we look forward to the next round because we have learnt so much and it has driven quite a bit of change within the organisation.
I do look at them. It's tricky because some sort of say we sort of almost it's a verification statement, what the information that is in this report is correct, but they don't necessarily, and I think that's where AA 1000 is helpful, doesn't necessarily say the right things are talked about in this report. And for me, I think that's probably even, that's equally important, or maybe even more important in some respects if you're not talking about the right thing. So I do look at the verification statement, the sorts of things, or the assurance statement, the statement that's been made, what actually has been covered and what's not been covered. And I do look at who's done it, and I guess I have it's not a big community in Australia, so you kind of know the sort of approaches that they use, and I certainly agree with Siobhan. I'm sure the companies get much greater value out of some approaches than they do other approaches, and I think companies getting value out of the insurance process is as important as an analyst as me getting some insurance. In fact, maybe even more so. And I say I do know what some of the insurance providers give in terms of feedback to their companies, and when I see it, I think that process has really added value to that company.
So, you know, for us, the assurance process was also, I really enjoyed it, even though it was hard work, because it was also an independent group coming in and asking questions in the business, and so it wasn't the internal corporate responsibility manager asking those questions, so it wasn't stakeholders asking questions, it was the assurance provider who was independent asking these questions, and actually kind of, made people more aware perhaps of some issues that they hadn't quite thought about before in the same kind of way. And it really, I think, actually drove even more engagement in the organisation through that process.
Excellent. Thank you very much. First of all, can I ask you to thank both Ian and Siobhan for their insight for the luncheon today?